We'll go to Exodus chapter 21. Exodus chapter 21. You thought we weren't ever going to get out of Exodus chapter 20. So did I. Exodus 21, beginning in verse 1, the Bible says, "Now these are the rules that you shall set before them. When you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go out free for nothing. If he comes in single, he shall go out single. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, 'I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free,' then his master shall bring him to God, and he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl, and he shall be his slave forever. When a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. If she does not please her master who has designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has broken faith with her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her as with a daughter. If he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights. And if he does not do these three things for her, she shall go out for nothing, without payment of money. Whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place to which he may flee. But if a man willfully attacks another to kill him by cunning, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. Whoever strikes his father or his mother shall be put to death. Whoever steals a man and sells him, and anyone found in possession of him, shall be put to death. Whoever curses his father or his mother shall be put to death. When men quarrel and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and the man does not die but takes to his bed, then if the man rises again and walks outdoors with his staff, he who struck him shall be clear. Only he shall pay for the loss of his time, and shall have him thoroughly healed. When a man strikes his slave, male or female, with a rod, and the slave dies under his hand, he shall be avenged. But if the slave survives a day or two, he is not to be avenged, for the slave is his money. When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her children come out, but there is no harm, the one who hit her shall surely be fined, as the woman's husband shall impose on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. When a man strikes the eye of his slave, male or female, and destroys it, he shall let the slave go free because of his eye. If he knocks out the tooth of his slave, male or female, he shall let the slave go free because of his tooth. When an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall be stoned and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall not be liable. But if the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past and its owner has been warned but has not kept it in, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned and its owner shall be put to death. If a ransom is imposed on him, and he shall give for the redemption of his life whatever is imposed on him. If it gores a man's son or daughter, he shall be dealt with according to this same rule. If the ox gores a slave, male or female, the owner shall give to their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned." And then things change into property rights, and we'll try hit that at a later time. This morning, we've got a message entitled "Liberty and Justice for All." You're familiar with our Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. I just remembered I was supposed to put the flags up after the wedding. Didn't do that. To the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. We're familiar with Lady Liberty as she holds the light, the torch of freedom, there in the harbor. It's been an inspiration for the world as immigrants from around the world have looked to this nation, one nation under God, E pluribus unum, out of the many, one. What a testimony has been this city shining on a hill. All the biblical imagery that's been connected with the United States of America. As we come to this particular passage, which may or may not get you very excited. I know we have one lawyer in the crowd here today, so at least we have that. But when I was talking to Jeff this morning, he said, you know, I was looking at what's coming ahead, and I thought, oh, it's a while before there's another story here in the text. Yep, we're going to have some slogging to do, or maybe not. Because when it comes to this passage, what we're given is nothing less than the foundation for a one people under God community. And what we'll see in this passage is that in particular, this one people under God have at the very core, at the very bottom, at the very foundation of their society, of their community, the fact that liberty and justice is for everybody in this community. And life is meant to be lived out under God within this community. Before ever there was an America, a city shining on a hill, it was Israel, planted at the center of the world, through which all the nations would come and conduct their commerce, through which all the nations would be exposed to this one true living God. And their eyes would see God's blessing on His people as they lived life in obedience to a wise word from God, as they lived out life in a jurisprudence that was given to them directly from God. At Sinai, we've seen what we might call, what others have called, apodictic law. That's just a fancy word that means these are necessary truths. These are the principles upon which all laws stand. For Israel, they boil down to three basic things. There is a God who's holy. And you, as a holy people, are bound to this holy God. Commandments 1 through 3. Commandment 4. This God blesses because of His grace to you. What He does for you, not based on what you can do for Him. Yes, you're responsible to Him, but in the long run, you can in no way benefit Him. You are dependent upon Him as beneficiaries. 5 through 10. As the beneficiaries of God's grace, you have an obligation to love each other. You who are the recipients of love must become the extenders of God's love. These are the principles upon which all of God's laws are founded. They're the cornerstones. They're the buttresses. They're the keystones of their jurisprudence, if you will. When we come to this section, there's going to be 613 laws in all, and we're not going to get through them in the book of Exodus. We'll have to wait till we get to Leviticus. But all the laws laid out. This, what we have here is called casuistic law, case law. So what we get is, in this case, here's what you do. In this case, here's how it's applied. In this case, this is where things go. When you come to law and legal issues, there's no shortage of scenarios. I was reminded of that this past month when I got a call from my mom and said, hey, you need to be praying for your uncle. My uncle retired from the Air Force about 20 years ago. He got into finances, and then he went to work for the post office as a mail carrier. And April 1st, my Uncle Doug retired from the post office. He's done being a mail carrier. And 1 week before he's done, he comes up the sidewalk, goes to drop the mail in that mailbox, and out of the door comes a pit bull. Jumps up on his arm. It's trying to bite for his throat. He's doing all he can to wrestle down this dog, throw it off him. He said if it had been a woman or a child, they would have been dead. He's screaming at the lady, call your dog off! Call your dog off! 20 stitches later and many lacerations, he finally walks away.
What do you do? Where's the law about the biting dog? Well, praise God, we have those laws in America, but we have those laws because those laws are on the books long before they were ever on the books in America. As we noted last week, chapters 21 through 23 in the book of Exodus is a collection of laws that are conventionally called the Book of the Covenant. These laws are case laws as opposed to the principal laws. These laws exhibit numerous parallels with other ancient Near Eastern law codes. But the big difference is this. These laws are hammered out not by Hammurabi. These law codes are spoken from the very mouth of God. So there's going to be some key distinctions and differences in these. At the beginning of this section in particular, verse 1 of chapter 21, God is speaking, and he says to Moses, "Now these are the rules that you shall set before them." Anybody have another word for God's word there? These are the rules, or these are the what? Witnesses, ordinances, judgments, the mishpatim, okay? The idea is these are the rulings. Boom, boom, boom. These are what I've decided. These are my declarations of how my law is to be interpreted, of how my law is to be applied. So to go back and look at the books, these are the books you go back to. I've thought it through. I've written out my judgment. I've written out my opinion. And guess what? It's the majority opinion, because I'm God. Okay? This is the majority opinion, and it stands as ruled. As he's giving these to Moses, these become the precedent by which all other laws are applied. They're the direct result of divine review and divine comment. As such, this section of the book of Exodus, even though it's not nearly as exciting as the Red Sea, as the battle with the Amalekites, as holding up your hands and winning, even though it's not maybe technically as exciting, it's every bit as important, and maybe even more so, because its divine purpose is to shape the thinking of God's people about life. When you come through all the doctrinal weight and heaviness of the book of Romans, you come to chapter 12. I beseech you, therefore, based on all of these weighty truths, this apodictic truth, I beseech you by the mercies of God that in every case, in every scenario in your life, you would present your bodies a living sacrifice, that you would be renewed in your what? In your mind. He says, listen, everything you do flows out of everything that's true about you, what you are. You have to apply it to every scenario in your life, and this can only get plugged into real life if it gets plugged into your brain. It will never reach your hands if it doesn't get plugged into your mind. It will never reach your feet if it doesn't get plugged into your heart. And so, while it would be tempting for us to say, and then there's some stuff there that really isn't all that interesting. Now, let's get to the good stuff. God takes a lot of time to lay this stuff out because he's trying to shape the way his people think. This portion of Scripture is meant to intersect life, where life is lived. You know what? You say, I just want some truth that applies. If you're hungry for application, then these texts are for you. This applies to real life. Where we're going this morning is this. True liberty is not simply the freedom to do what I want, but the ability to do what I ought. What's going to happen here is we're going to get to two fundamental truths for applying God's law. The first is this. The execution of justice is in the context of freedom. Look at verse 2. He starts out with a case law about slavery. When you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years, and the seventh he shall go out free for nothing. This case law starts out with law about slavery. Do you remember where the apodictic law of the Ten Commandments started out? Go back to chapter 20 and look at verse 2. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. He starts with his case law in the same place that he started his apodictic law. He starts with the fact, now listen, you're a redeemed people. Everything in your life is going to be touched by the fact that you're free, that you're redeemed, that you're ransomed, that you are set free by God for your potential to reach holiness, to be holy like I am holy. But it's not going to be something that I twist your arm and make you do. You have the freedom to do as you ought. Because of my redemption in the past, it ought to be something that you want to do. But it's your choice. Moses says, as he's laying out this law to that second generation, he says, now look at this. I've laid out for you these statutes, these rules, these judgments. To follow them is life. To disregard them is death. Now the choice is up to you. You have freedom to choose. The execution of justice, especially with this society, is always in the context of freedom. Hebrew slavery, when you buy a Hebrew slave, you wouldn't expect this at this point necessarily. You would expect an Israelite. God is referring to them as a one people viewed from the outside. Hebrew slavery looks different from all other forms of slavery within the ancient Near East. It was meant to be voluntary. It could not be enforced. Look down at verse 16 of chapter 21. It says, whoever steals a man and sells him, and anyone found in possession of this man, shall be what? Okay. You cannot enforce slavery upon a free man, upon point of death. Okay. The way we think of slavery, with the way that we know slavery, the way slavery was conducted within the United States of America is, we go over, we steal people out of their huts, out of their houses, we corral them into a ship, we bring them across to the free world, and we sell them into slavery. We've taken free people, made them bound, and held them captive. Okay. God says that's not how Hebrew slavery works. Hebrew slavery was voluntary. It was more of an indentured servant system. And there were many reasons for which one would indenture themselves. It was meant as a means of financial security in a relationship that fostered responsibility. Then, just like now, personal setbacks within their culture were often the result of wrong choices, irresponsibility, sometimes sin. So, financial setback within this community of blessing, where God is sending rains on time and God is giving increase in the fruits and the crops, and God is blessing both the table and the fold and the vine and everything around them. In this land of God's blessing, financial reversals are often on the shoulders of individuals who are either lazy, wanting something for nothing, unwise, or just downright selfish and taking. When God lays out some future laws, he's going to say, now listen, if you don't have enough, or you think you don't have enough, and you take from somebody else, you must pay them back what you took, and you must give them four times what you took. In some cases, it's five times what you took. Guess what? You're going to have a hard time paying that back. Now what do? You declare bankruptcy. Oh, now I'm off the hook, right? Nope. Now you just indentured yourself to the one that you're indebted to work off your debt. It was meant as a means of financial security for those folks that had these financial reversals. So what do? you go and pledge your services to someone who will meet your needs. They'll put a roof over your head. They'll put food on your table. They'll put clothes on your back. Well, those are basic fundamental needs. Those are securities that we need within the society. But it also builds in a responsibility for those goods. But not all personal setbacks were the result of wrong choices. This system allows a family to regain their feet in a community by seeing that their basic needs are met. This is always meant to be a blessing. It's never meant to be a constringent factor within the society. It was voluntary. Secondly, it was temporary. Hebrew slaves literally received a sabbatical. I'm going to get a sabbatical. Boy, they have it better than we do. Every seventh year, they're let go from Danken to do their own thing, and then they can come back. Actually, what happens is when they're released, the master was supposed to supply them with everything he needs to make a new start for himself. Go up to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 15. Start in verse 12. If your brother, a Hebrew man or Hebrew woman, is sold to you, he shall serve you 6 years. In the seventh year, you shall let him go free from you. And when you let him go free from you, you shall not let him go empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally out of your flock, out of your threshing floor, and out of your winepress. As the Lord your God has blessed you, you shall give to him. And you shall remember that you yourself were a slave in the land of Egypt. The Lord your God redeemed you, and that's why I command you this day. So this slave system was never meant to create slaves. It was always meant to create freemen. It was always meant to be a redemptive factor within the society. However, there was also provision for this to remain permanent. You go back just a little bit in the text and you see how it is that he lays this one out. In verse 4, if the master gives him a wife and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children belong to the master. Only the man goes out alone. But, verse 5, if the slave plainly says, I love my master, I love my wife, I love my children, I will not go out free, then his master shall bring him to God. He shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl. He'll be his slave forever. Most of the time, this was a temporary feature within the society. You're in indentured bondage up to 7 years, working to get your feet back under you so that you can get back out into society. But there were cases where this could become a permanent feature. As such, it required a public declaration. Go out to bring him to God, and he must plainly say. The idea is out in public, whether it's in front of the elders of the society, if it would be that place of worship, a synagogue of sorts within that local realm. But the idea is before God and before man, I'm declaring my commitment to this one who's taken me under his roof. It's a public declaration with a private ceremony. Once he's made this declaration, they bring him back to the house, and there at the household of which he's becoming a member, he brings his ear, and he's welcomed as a legitimate member of this household, but he does it in a rather painful way. They take the Phillips screwdriver, and they take that ear, and they, boom, they pop it right through. Well, guess what gets stuck to that doorpost? Part of his ear, along with blood. What happens in this private ceremony is there's a covenant. He's already made it out in public. It's sealed in blood as that lobe hangs from the doorpost. But what he's saying is, I have a permanent bond with this man. Now, forever, wherever he goes, he bears the mark that he doesn't belong to himself. The New Testament uses the term, he's a bond slave. That's what Paul says when he refers to himself most often in Scripture. Paul, a slave of Jesus, not a whipping boy of Jesus. Paul, the one who's finally found a kindly master, a loving master, a generous master, a gracious master. You know what I've done? I'm declaring publicly before God and man, I want my ear nailed to his door. I want to serve this guy forever. See, here's my mark. I don't belong to me. I belong to my master. What an awesome picture, isn't it? There was built into this society a permanence if desired. And it wouldn't have been desired if the master wasn't a kind and generous master. It's a choice. It's voluntary. Meant to be temporary, capable of being permanent, but it's always meant to be civil. As we look through this, the terms for female slaves aren't quite the same as they are for the man. Look at verse 2. When you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh, he shall go free. Verse 7. When a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not go out like the male slaves do. Wait a minute. That's not fair. Right? It's not meant to be fair. It's meant to be good. Let's track this down just a little bit. The term for female slaves, as they're laid out here, actually elevates their status within the society, not vice versa. You understand that female slaves were never given rights at all in any other cultures. And God, in speaking to the rights of female slaves, isn't doing it to subjugate them and beat them down and keep them in their place. If he wanted to do that, he wouldn't have said anything about it, because that's how everybody else already treated the female slaves. In fact, guy slaves too, for that matter. That's just how slavery was done. What God is doing in this society, he says, listen, nobody can take, and you can't take and sell somebody against this will, but verse 7 kind of looks like that might be the case. Here's a man selling his daughter into slavery. What's that all about? Some kind of dad. Sure glad I didn't have him as my dad. The idea is more like an arranged marriage. Philip Ryken in his commentary says this is really, it's a form of adoption. And this is a means by which this lady can better her current lot and secure for herself a better future. What happens is she's removed from the financial tensions of a home that's cash-strapped, if you will. Remember that women were, there was a dowry that was required when a woman was brought into a relationship with a man. You want my daughter? Here's the bride price, and here's what goes along with her. She didn't have anything to give, per se, and so the prices were brought down, provided a dowry. And in verse 8, the master then would either designate her for himself, or verse 9, he would designate her for his son. The master is free. The son is free. So whether she becomes a wife of the master or the master's son, what is she? Free. That's the point. Okay? If any man arranges a marriage on these financial terms, she may not yet be of age, but we're calculating her future. It's for her benefit. These are the terms by which we operate. The distinction that they could not be released like the male servants in verse 7 was for their protection, for their provision. It wasn't an abusive restriction. You see what it says there in verse 10. If he takes for himself another wife, he shall not, he cannot, by order of God's law, diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights, probably conjugal relations. He cannot take those away from her. Those are insured by God. If he does, there's no slavery. She's free. Because they have abused. In fact, it says he has broken faith at the end of verse 8 with her. This is a contract. And he's been treacherous in his promise. Treachery within the community, no slavery. That bond is broken. Well, how about back up in verse 4, where the man goes out, but the woman doesn't? Well, remember, A lot of the reason for the indentured servitude is the fact that the guy blew it financially. He's been either a reprobate with his money, or he's been a reprobate with his character, and he's stolen somebody else's property, and he's gone bankrupt. He's gone in the hock because he's having to pay this stuff back. Now for some 7 years, he's put in this relationship where he's responsible to, he's under, he's even allowed to be beaten. Physical pain is given to the right of the master to help this guy to get it. So for 7 years, he's learning to be responsible. The time comes, he gets to go free. But his wife, you know what? You go see how you do. I'm giving you everything you need to succeed. Now, set up your home. We'll see what happens. In time, he could gain enough money, enough funds, to come back to his master and say, "Can I pay the ransom for my wife and my children? I've been successful. I've been responsible." Or he could fall on his face again, squander it, be irresponsible. But you know who doesn't have to suffer for it this time? His wife and kids. They're taken care of. He gets out of prison. He goes to do this work, to try on life as a freeman once again. But you know who's not going to suffer this time? His wife and kids. He's going to fall on his face all by himself this time. This was actually a very compassionate term within the society. In the context of God's redeemed people, even slavery had a redemptive purpose. The execution of justice is always done in the context and with a view towards freedom. Freedom. On the other hand, the enjoyment of my freedom is always in the context of justice. I'm not free to do anything I want. Somebody said, my freedom ends where the other guy's nose begins, right? Okay? I'm not free to do anything I want. I'm in context with other people. And so my freedom is in fact limited in a free society. What we see in verses 12 through 17 is that social justice requires proper valuation of human life. This is the reason for the death penalty. The death penalty was in place before ever God gave these commandments on Mount Sinai. It goes back to Genesis chapter 9 after the flood. God says, Noah, as you go back into this world that's been replenished, been wiped out of all human life, I want you to understand that the violence that was so prevalent before this flood must not become prevalent again. Here's the rule. If a man sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. Why? Because I want you to understand, Noah, that from the beginning, man has always been made in the image of God. Human life is so valuable that when one reaches out and snuffs out the life of another, the only thing that can take that place is his life. So very often, the opposition to the death penalty is, we need to value life by not taking life. Actually, if we preserve the life of those who take lives, we're undervaluing the lives that have been taken. God says this is the distinction that needs to be made. And there is a distinction, as he says there in verse 13. Now, if he didn't lie in wait for the man to kill him, but instead God let him fall into his hand, the axe head slipped off his axe, he got caught in whatever, he didn't mean to set out to murder this guy, he distinguishes between homicide and manslaughter, then there's places that he can go to escape judgment. But if he runs even to the very temple of God and places his hands on the horns of the altar, if he's guilty, God says, I make my declaration now. You have the right to take his hands off that altar and slay him. Because that's how much you must value life. I want you to understand that I'm a life-giving God. And in this community, you will turn everything upside down if you don't value life as much as I value it. There's a high premium on human life. He says there in verse, well, we already looked at verse 16, there's no kidnapping. Both the one who provides and the one who consumes the product of a slave are both put to death. The idea is don't create a market and there won't be any profit in it. Okay. We're removing all profit from this market by killing both the one who supplies and the one who consumes slaves. Then you have these two, verse 15 and verse 17, with reference to rebellion or throwing off parental constraint. Verse 15, whoever strikes his father or his mother shall be put to death. And again, in the ancient Near East, mothers weren't treated with the same respect as fathers. What God does in this law code is he says, it doesn't matter, male, female. It matters position as parent over child. And the word strike here isn't just a slap. It's the idea of a violent action that causes or intends to cause permanent harm. It could be rising up in an attempt to slay. It's turning around and biting the hand that feeds you in a very literal sense. But not just that, verse 17. Whoever curses his father or mother shall be put to death. In the New Testament, Jesus cites this one. The word that's used in English is whoever reviles his parent. The idea is the exact opposite of honoring. The one who treats lightly. But it goes farther. It has the idea of wishing their ill. It's a violent attitude that invokes permanent damage. It's exactly opposite of giving them honor. It says, if the breakdown of the home is such that this child is so utterly rebellious toward his parents that he would intentionally and violently seek their demise, that person, if he's willing to do that to his parents, he's a threat to the entire society. You owe it to the community to take his life. God is very active in preserving and sanctioning and valuing human life and the structure of the society that he's creating. Social justice requires a proper valuation of human life. Social justice requires a proper valuation in restitution. So beginning in verse 18, we see a couple guys are fighting. The fight is not premeditated. It's played out with the weapons that are at hand. The fight doesn't result in death. It simply results in injury. But the winner of the fight is responsible for damages. And there's a focus both on the loss of income and a focus on his medical care. There in verse 19, if the man rises again and walks outdoor with his staff, the one who struck him shall be clear. But he will pay for his loss of time. He will have him all the way to be thoroughly healed. That's the case of free men. What about with a slave? Well, in the case of a slave, the murder of a slave still requires a death penalty. He's still a human. Again, this is brand new in the ancient Near East. A man could do whatever he wanted with his slave, including killing him. In fact, in Roman society, a man had authority over not just his slaves, but his children. That the law could not get involved if a man said, I want my son killed. I want my daughter killed. They would just expose their children upon birth to the elements if they didn't want them. God is valuing human life in a unique way, unprecedented in the history of the world, until God comes up with the idea. In the case of a slave, murder still requires the death penalty because the slave still bears the image of God. And there's equal consequence both for male slaves and female slaves. Doesn't matter. But the injury of the slave requires no compensation because if after a few days he survives his injuries, gets back to work, the loss, the monetary loss in that relationship really falls upon the master. So he's the one who doesn't have a slave doing the work. There's no compensation because the loss is already incurred by the master. Social justice then requires proper valuation in punishment. You come down to verse 22. Now we have two men who are fighting, and there happens to be a pregnant woman on the sidelines. We don't know what she's doing there. We don't know exactly what's going on. We just know that there's a pregnant woman on the scene, and she gets hit. She gets violently bumped, bruised, injured to such a degree that her baby or babies are delivered at that point. If there's any damage done, either to mom or child, he says this is what happens. If there's an eye that's injured, the eye needs to be taken from the one who delivered the injury. If there's a foot, if there's a wound, if there's a burn, if there's a tooth, if the life is taken, it doesn't matter if the child, if the person, if the human being whose life is snuffed out is in utero, it's still a person who bears the image of God. Again, this is unprecedented in the history of the world, where God says the life of a baby inside its mother's body is as valuable to me as anybody who owns property in a big mansion up on the hill. What? God says, let me tell you, I want you to enjoy your freedom, but there are limits to your freedom. Your freedom is always enjoyed in the context of justice. You owe it to each other to love them in this way. He goes on, this is the law of lex talionis, the law of retaliation. You know what I can take from somebody who harms me? I don't collect from them because I've suffered emotional abuse. How much does it hurt? I can't put a price tag on my feelings. Okay. You know what? What did you lose? That's what you're owed. No more, no less. Okay. So for those damages, he puts that context in there and says, this is the maximum that can be extracted. In other places, we're going to see that a price can be put on them and there can be a price that's paid. Social justice extends to the unborn. It extends to the slaves. It extends with regard to harm that's caused by animals. And it takes account of them as first-time offenders. You don't know what that animal's going to do. This animal that doesn't have, it has free will to an extent, but it doesn't have a mind to be able to process things. You can't understand the character of a cow. And it doesn't talk about horses, because horses weren't generally owned by Israelites. That they were kind of a foreign commodity. So he talks about, what happens if this cow goes out of its way to gore you? Well, if it didn't have a history of it, you put it to death, because the cost of a life requires a life. And then you don't get to benefit from that beef. You stone it, you bury it, it's gone. It would be wrong to eat that because it came at the price of a precious person. So that's how I want you to think about life in this covenant context. It extends to the harm caused by animals, taking account first-time offenders, but then it also takes into account negligence. In verse 29, he says, listen, if that ox has a history of goring, it didn't kill anybody in the past, okay? Because if it had, and you didn't, and you didn't confine it, or you didn't kill it, then you would be breaking a law. But it's gored somebody, it's injured them in the past, and now negligently you've let it get out again, and it causes trouble. Both the ox and the owner are held responsible. The owner must be put to death. You know, it's an amazing thing to think through the fact that even negligence, we can be held accountable for. And you know what? Negligence can happen so easily. But I'm responsible for the life of those around me. I was reminded of this shortly after I got to seminary. I was working at a tube mill, and I was working at a bench, and my hand got caught in the rollers, went through the rollers, and bones in there got broken. After I got back from the doctor, I was at work. I couldn't operate a bench. I couldn't move things, so they stuck me up in the crane, the overhead crane up top. I could operate that with one hand. It was kind of a cushy job. I enjoyed it. Till one day, I came down from that crane. I was just trembling. I was shaking. I had just passed over my brother's bench, got to the end of the line, starting to put my boom down. I look out at the end of my boom, and there at the end of the boom where that ring is, where the hooks lock into that boom. My hook wasn't inside the ring. That ring was resting just on top of that hook. And I just brought that, 2,000-pound boom right over my brother's head. But I'd been negligent. I hadn't made sure that my hook was inside the ring. But God says, I want you to value human life so much that you're thinking about others all the time. You know what? That's a big deal. This generation is a generation where we even have presidential candidates that think nothing about others and think only of how did we get here? Because we've walked away from God's laws and we've taught our children that they're the most important thing in the world. You know what? They're not. They have a responsibility to be thinking about others. As we conclude, I just want to drive home one more time. True liberty is not simply the freedom to do what I want. It's the ability to do what I ought. The story is told of Abraham Lincoln, who once went to a slave auction. He was appalled to see the buying and selling of human beings. His heart was drawn to one woman in particular whose story was told in her eyes, eyes of hatred, eyes of hurt. She looked with contempt on everybody around and must have been abused all her life. This time was but one more nick, one more tick in her belt of cruel humiliation. The bidding began and Lincoln bid. As other bids were offered, Lincoln would up it until finally he won. When he paid the auctioneer the money, he took the title to the young woman and she stared back at him with vicious contempt and asked, "What are you going to do with me?" He said, "I'm going to set you free." She was taken off guard. Free? What do you mean free? Free for what? Just free. Completely free. Trying to process it, the woman says, "Free? You mean like free to do whatever I want?" "Yes, free to do whatever you want." "Free? Free to say whatever I want?" "Free to say whatever you want." Free to go wherever I want to go? "Free to go wherever you want to go. And mister, I want to go with you." When you stop and you look at all the fact that these laws that we can never keep perfectly, Jesus comes up on the scene and he says, "You know what? I have come not to destroy the law, not to get rid of the law, but to fulfill the law. Who being in the form of God thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but took upon him the form of a servant and was made in the likeness of man." You know what? When God calls us to be his, he says, "This is the way life was meant to be lived. Justice in the context of freedom. Freedom in the context of justice. Now, will you be mine? Will you be mine? I want you to understand, I want you to be my bond slave, but understand that I sent my son to serve you first." What an amazing God. Can't you trust your life to that kind of God? I think we can. Let's pray.